Enough water, just enough wine, just enough crumbs, a dollar and a dime, just enough hope to keep us toeing the line. But sooner or later, take it all back. Will they keep us separated by the shade of our skin?
Well, that's Sooner or Later by Eliza Gilkinson. It's from her album 2020, full of really hard-hitting political songs. Highly recommended album. She's done a lot of great albums, but this, I think, is her best. We use it as the introduction to Activist Radio, where we offer history you didn't learn in high school, news you haven't seen on TV, and music to help you join the resistance. Activist Radio can be heard on Thursdays 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College, Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. from WIOF 104.1 FM in Woodstock, and Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. from the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can find our past programs as a podcast, any number of a bunch of different places, Google Play, iTunes, Digital Podcast, Stitcher. Just search on Activist Radio, find the podcast to download. You can also listen to us anytime on the web at classwars.org. Our last 10 programs are there. Our guest today is going to be Tom Hartman, top-rated progressive national and internationally syndicated talk show host and New York Times best-selling author of over 30 books. We're going to talk about his most recent published work, and that's The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. Which brings me, the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, its board of trustees, or its constituents. Just the views of me today, Fred, and I'm bringing you up to date on America's hidden class wars.
Medication from the poor, take the children from their mothers. We can't take it anymore, 'cause sooner or later.
One day our whispers will be louder than your screams. One day our whispers will be louder than your screams. One day our whispers will be louder than your screams. The people's day will come. Emma Goldman sang this song for you. Big Bill Haywood and Mother Jones too. Psycho and Vanzetti, they took your lives. But we can organize. One day our whispers will be louder than your screams.
Well, it's a little bit of The People's Day by Otis Gibbs. It's the introduction to the first part of Activist Radio, History We Don't Think You Learned in High School. It's an important part of Activist Radio. I think the biggest problem of the left is that we don't know our own leftist history in this country. And I think that that has been done on purpose. The media, the textbooks, they leave out the idea that you can change society in the streets, that social movements, organizing, marching, petitioning, can actually change the course of history. The major media, corporate-owned, does not want us to realize that fact. And therefore, I think this is something that Activist Radio should continue to do, just looking at the history of social struggle in making us a better country. We're going to go to our day in history, February 11th, 1790. And on this day, the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery, composed mostly of Quakers and Mennonites, petitioned Congress for the emancipation of all slaves. This is 50-something years before the Civil War. And back then, Benjamin Franklin had really become the most vocal abolitionist in our history to that point. In 1787, just 3 years before, he began to serve as president of the society, which not only advocated the abolition of slavery, but made efforts to integrate freed slaves into American society, you know, way, way before most of Americans had been thinking of these issues. And the proposed resolution, the one we're talking about, 1790, was immediately attacked, denounced by pro-slavery congressmen, not only from the South. By this time, Wall Street had seen the profits of slavery, so there were pro-slavery congressmen from the North as well. And the resolution sparked a really heated debate in both House and Senate. It didn't pass, but it certainly brought up the issue. We know the issue gets brought up again and again in our history, and 72 years later, the failure to pass this petition for abolition would lead to the death of 620,000 U.S. citizens, and the highest casualty rate of any war the U.S. has ever fought. And I think this is just part of the price of slavery in this country, the slaughter of one side slaughtering the soldiers of another, and the North and the South coming to a calamitous war that brought the end of slavery. Well, the abolitionist movement was a bit more complicated than a few white politicians arguing to free the slaves. You know, they were both black and white abolitionists, and they essentially worked together to mount this increasing decades-long assault on the institution of slavery. Well, they sent hundreds of petitions to Congress, held innumerable abolition meetings and conferences, boycotted products made from slave labor. That's really interesting. And then boycotted the rum that came from molasses. They boycotted molasses, all products that came from, they indicated, slave labor. So the boycott movement was very important. They printed just vast quantities of petitions. You can still read these petitions today. They gave thousands of speeches for their cause, national speeches, but also in people's homes. They would invite their friends in, and sometimes they would have an ex-slave to talk about how he or she was treated in the South. So these speeches were both national and very local. And by the 1840s, slavery had become a major fault line in the New Republic. Black and white abolitionists, however, didn't agree on all points. Whites tended to simply want to end the institution of slavery, and they thought that everything else would fall into position after that. But black abolitionists tend to focus on racial equality, the need for social justice. And we know from this vantage point that ending slavery was nowhere near enough. Without equality and without justice, African Americans were to suffer more than a half century of murderous Jim Crow treatment after Reconstruction was ended. The 1878 or 1879. And I think in this new era of self-discovery, our own era, many authors have turned to re-examining our slave history. Of course, there's Michelle Alexander, and she covers pretty much the entire history of racial subjugation, pointing out things that we may have known or just heard, but putting it in context. Start with Michelle Alexander. Others like The Kidnap Club, Wall Street Slavery and Resistance on the Eve of the Civil War, a book telling us how Wall Street, the New York Police Department, colluded to make millions from slave labor before the Civil War, essentially making money by kidnapping blacks, freed blacks, and selling them back to slavery in the South. And more recently, even we see that black families, a whole history of black families being cheated out of their wealth over numerous generations, and that would be Richard Rothstein's The Color of Law. All these books helping, I think, both white and black people realize what their history is in this country. But I think it's more aimed at white people because, you know, white people have lived this and black people have lived it. But living oppression, if you're the oppressed people, you know what oppression looks like. Maybe you don't know the laws, maybe you don't know some of the history, but you know the essential fact in America that we live in a class society structured around the color of a person's skin. And white people have a lot to learn, you know. That's I think I aim this history, you know, I create this history so that white people can start to understand what their role was and continues to be in a racist society. Well, can Black Lives Matter sustain a multiracial movement focused on equality and social justice in our current age? We know that the progress engenders the opposite forces, well, like the KKK or more recently the Proud Boys. And they're dangerous movements. They're killers. They would subvert racial justice, but they would also subvert our very democracy, as we have just recently seen with the attack on the Capitol. But I'm confident that together, you know, we can fight the forces of white nationalism and finally defeat the lingering racism in our shared society. And we'll be doing it not for white people and not just for black people. We'll be doing it for all citizens. It's a multiracial society. We're doing it in order to make, well, a more perfect union, a union grounded on justice. Let's go to Nina Simone now. And the song is, oh, just an amazing song. You can watch Nina Simone sing this on YouTube, and it's well worth the experience. But it's Nina Simone singing Backlash Blues. Thank you.
back lines. Who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, send my only son and son to Vietnam. You see what happened there. You give me second class houses, second class schools. You know all colored people in this country got to be second class fools. And it's true now. That's the truth now. It's true now. I know how to leave you with the blues. Ah. Hey, hey, when I try to find a job to get a little cash, all you're gonna hand me is your 2 cent backlash. But the world's big, big and bright and round, black and round, full of other folks like me who are black, beige, and brown. I'm backlash and Kissinger. I'm gonna leave you, and you already got 'em. The blues. Give the drama some. Like Odetta said last night, if you don't get loose now, you better forget it. 'Cause you ain't got much time. None of us do. I think the Rolling Stones say we got 5 years. When my daughter tries to find a little job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer her is your stupid, same stupid old mean backlash. But the world is big, I saw it, big and bright and round, and it's full of other folks like me who are Japanese, black and beige and brown. Oh, Mr. Backlash, you're not the only ones, that's what you've been thinking. I'm gonna leave ya, I'm gonna leave ya, I'm gonna leave you with the blues. Wanted to accept you. Black. You see that brother down there looking up the ceiling? And white, they're easier. The blacks, never, never. Yeah, I'm gonna tell you the truth tonight. He said, Nina, keep on working till they open up the door. You know who you are, and you know you
either been here or you never been here before. Don't make no difference. And when they open up the door, make sure you tell them where it's at, so they'll have no other place to hide behind all them strange hats. So I'm gonna leave you with the blues.
They lied, they lied, they took us for a ride. Tried burying the truth wherein very nearly died. They lied, but no matter what they tried to hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out. Everybody knows they lied. I ain't telling you nothing you don't already know, but the government's...
Well, that's a little bit of They Lied by Jay Mankita. It's the lead into the next part of Activist Radio. We take a look at stories that usually are just not reported in the U.S. media, and we put them on a website called fantasylandmedia.org. It's got a lot of hits over the last 10 years, in part because it's keyword searchable. So you can see what was left out of the New York Times on civil liberties, for example, you know, 8 or 10 years ago. It gives you a history of the omissions of our corporate media. We think it's an in-depth look at the failings of this media, where all the news is fashioned by the people in charge. You know who that is, the corporations and your government. Our first story today is from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. That's FAIR. Quote, U.S. media require no evidence for claims of electoral fraud in Venezuela. The media establishment was horrified when the, quote, Stop the Steal mob stormed into the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and the sentence was swift. President Donald Trump, with his baseless fraud allegations and refusals to concede defeat, was responsible for the mayhem. Corporate outlets have summarily denounced Trump's bogus claims of vote fraud, though for years they have faithfully echoed similar spurious accusations made about elections held by official enemies. And there's, FAIR goes on to quote seven different stories that outlined the inability of the U.S. media to accept the election results of, quote, U.S. Enemies. Continuing on, but the media make no effort to account for years of hypocrisy and double standards. Venezuela's December 6th parliamentary election offers an instructive case study, with corporate journalists unquestioningly repeating Trump's officials' unsubstantiated allegations of fraud there. At the same time, they debunk Trump's virtually identical claims vis-a-vis the U.S. election. And the right-wing violence that was rightly portrayed as a threat to democracy in the U.S. was hardly endorsed as a democratic campaign in Venezuela, where it served Washington's foreign policy goals. Well, I think Venezuela is really one of the worst examples of the New York Times following the Pentagon's lead when it talks about coverage of elections, Venezuela elections. But it isn't just Venezuela, of course. When it comes to elections in all enemies of the empire, all pretense of truthful election reporting gets thrown out the window. The second story is from Common Dreams. Quote, Congressional report reveals manufacturers, quote, knowingly sold toxin-tainted baby food. This is what happens when you let the food and the chemical companies, not the FDA, decide whether our food is safe to eat. Leading baby food manufacturers are selling, knowingly and without warning, unsafe products contaminated with dangerous levels of toxic heavy metals that can cause serious and often irreversible damage to infant brain development. This is according to a new congressional investigation that is generating renewed calls for greater regulation of the industry. About time, huh? Dangerous, quote, dangerous levels of toxic metals like arsenic, lead, cadmium, mercury exist in baby foods at levels that exceed what experts and governing bodies say are permissible, unquote. That was Representative Raja Krishnamurthy, chairman of the House Subcommittee on Economic Consumer Policy, which conducted the investigation, and that quote was what he told CNN recently. Well, I'm waiting for the story of the corporate and FDA collusion in exposing millions of babies to toxic baby food. It's a story, I'm really surprised the New York Times isn't covering it. And the only thing I can think of is maybe the story is just too shameful for our newspaper of record. You know, it's a government that doesn't function for its people when it lets its babies be poisoned by these large corporations who run the Food and Drug Administration. Maybe that is just essentially too shameful for the New York Times to print. It, I think it always keeps in mind the good name of the United States when it carries stories, but it did not carry this story, and I think it definitely should have. All the people who use baby food, you know, over the years, people who worry about corporate influence, you know, this is a story the New York Times and the mainstream media should have run and didn't. This story is actually a reporting on the NPR Morning Edition that was on February 3rd. A guest from the Anti-Defamation League was introduced to comment on racism in America. The ADF, that's the Anti-Defamation League, is probably the very last organization that should be given airtime to discuss racial or religious hatreds. From its beginning tracking neo-Nazis and other right-wing groups, the ADF has devolved into attacking what it calls Arab propaganda on university campuses and branding any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. And then there is the spying the ADF has done on the ACLU, on Greenpeace, NAACP, United Farm Workers. In addition, the ADL was instrumental in opposing the building of the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center and the proposed mosque and Islamic Culture Center in Lower Manhattan. The ADF used its links to the New York Police Department to insert its racist views into police training as well by showing the movie The Third Jihad, a violently Islamophobic film, to over 1,500 of its officers in training. And the ADF really was responsible for introducing that film into the training program of the New York Police Department. Quite amazing. NPR's decision to use ADL to comment on racial extremism in America is typical of what is now referred to as PEP, and that's progressive, except for Palestine. Well, we have just about enough time for a song here, and this song is by me, Fred Nagel. And the true story of what happened when a number of veterans went out to Standing Rock the night the wind storm, the snowstorm came in. So the song is called Sitting Bull Protects Us.
Yes, Sitting Bull protects us. His house was on this land. The wind may blow the drifting snow, but here we make our stand. The storm had caught us unaware in the middle of the night. And it tore our tent to pieces and set us all in flight. We crept along the snowbanks just looking for our way. We had to find some shelter to see another day. Sitting Bull protects us, his house was on this land. The wind may blow the drifting snow, but here we make our stand. A tent flap opened in the wind and we all crawled inside. The light that flickered from the roof showed dozens side by side. I sat down next to someone with a blanket round their head, and I listened to the howling winds that filled my heart with dread. Sitting Bull protects us, his house was on this land. The wind may blow the drifting snow, but he'll make our stand. Tent is blowing over, I told my silent friend. The walls are caving in now, I can see the tent poles bend. Blanket moved beside me, revealing her proud head. And her dark eyes caught a bit of light, and this is what she said. Sitting Bull protects us, his house was on this land. The wind may blow the drifting snow, but here we make our stand. The dawn came on so slowly as I shivered in the cold. The tent flapped wildly in the storm, but somehow it did hold. I never saw her in the light that brought the newborn day. She wasn't there beside me, still I heard her say. Sitting Bull protects us, his house was on this land. The wind may blow the drifting snow, but here we make our stand. Yeah, here
stand. All right, that was Sitting Bull Protects Us, true story of the week I spent out at Standing Rock with a bunch of veterans. Almost seemed like we were causing more trouble than we were actually doing good in stopping the pipeline. We did march at times, but I think that the Lakota elders were more worried about us dying off. And that night was amazing when the whole tent fell in, and I'd say about 50 or maybe 60 people were just out in the snow for a while until we found another tent to take us up. So Sitting Bull protects us. Hope you enjoyed it. Well, we have our guest coming up, and this is an interesting interview. Tom Hartman, of course, he's pretty well recognized, top rated progressive national and internationally syndicated talk show host. He's on a million radio stations. He's also a New York Times best-selling author. He's got over 30 books he's written over the years. And we pretty much talked about his most recent book. We've had Tom on our program before, about 6 months ago, talking about another book. But this book is called The Hidden History of the American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. So we had a good talk about what makes an oligarchy, why it's so dangerous, and of course most of the book was written before the Capitol Hill invasion, but The invasion of Congress makes the book, you know, even more readable and even more interesting. So let's go to that interview.
All right, Tom Hartman, top-rated progressive national and international syndicated talk show host and New York Times best-selling author of at least 30 books. We talked today about The Hidden History, his new book, The Hidden History of Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. Thank you so much, Tom, for being on Activist Radio.
It is a pleasure and an honor, Fred, to talk with you again.
Well, thank you. I'm wondering why the history of oligarchy is so important that you write a book about it, and also why you say that it's hidden. Why is the history often hidden from us?
Well, first of all, the reason why it's hidden, I think there's the extent that the is owned by anyone, and large, the vast majority actually of American media is owned by a relatively small number of people and companies. Those are the same oligarchs who would just as soon not discuss oligarchy. The reason why it's important is that the literal definition of a functioning democracy is a political system where the wishes and desires of the majority of the people are translated into legislation, into actual government behavior. And Matt Gillens and Benjamin Page produced an amazing study 6 years ago out of Northwestern University and what they found was that prior to the Reagan Revolution, prior to the mid-1980s, if you were to take public opinion surveys of public policy, you know, of what could become law, and whether it was social issues, you know, gay marriage, or whether it was economic issues, the minimum wage, you know, whatever it may be, if you were to take the public opinion polls of potential legislative issues and compare them with actual legislative outcomes, what you'd find is that well over half the time, what the bottom 90% of America wanted actually got translated into legislation, which is why we have Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and long-term unemployment insurance and the minimum wage, all those things that the oligarchs oppose and that the institutional, the Republican Party, which is the party of the oligarchs, oppose. But something funky started happening in the 1980s as a result of the Reagan Revolution. And if you look at public opinion polls versus on policy issues versus actual legislative outcomes post 1995, more or less, you know, 15 years into the Reagan Revolution, what you find is that and right up to today. And in fact, we're seeing this played out right now in this legislative thing over whether people should get a $2,000 check. What you find is that the desires of the bottom 90% are, to quote Gillens and Page, the correlation is roughly equivalent to random noise. In other words, that correlation connection has been broken. What the bottom 90% of Americans want legislatively is no longer what they get. It has no relationship to what they get. But what the top 3% want, since the mid-1990s, has consistently been converted into public policy through a series of massive tax cuts, a couple of international wars, $600 billion a year subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, you know, a $7 trillion backup program for, you know, post crash of 2008 and now the current one for giant corporations. Those things do get made into law, which means that somewhere in the 1990s, as a result of the Reagan Revolution, we ceased to be a functioning democracy, and we became a functioning oligarchy, where the oligarchs call the tune, and the oligarchs get what they want. And that's why it's so important, because, you know, we're still telling ourselves that this is a democratic republic, and I think it's still possible for us to get back there, but it's going to be a hell of a lift.
Yeah, you really build up such an interesting case for how oligarchy promotes itself and becomes stronger and stronger, and all the different ways that it's done that throughout our history. There's been a few defeats. You term the Civil War and Reconstruction as a defeat of antebellum South, which was an oligarchy, and of course FDR's revolution. You also talk about a window of being able to defeat an oligarchy, and what happens when a country goes past the window and the oligarchy becomes possibly too allied with the army and other aspects of American society. It's too late to change. Are we close to that window?
We were very close to it before Joe Biden got elected president. Donald Trump was taking us full bore into that conversion, which frequently happens, where a country goes first from being a democratic republic to being an oligarchy, and then the people start to rebel basically against the oligarchs, and so the oligarchs begin converting the nation into a police state in order to cement their and hold their power. And that was the process that Trump was beginning we've had 14,000 people arrested in Black Lives Matter protests across the United States. You know, his taking the military in to clear it's now Black Lives Matter Square. These kinds of just a whole variety of the behaviors, criminalizing, defacing statues and things. I mean, in a heavy, felony way. These are the signs of an incipient police state. And I really, truly believe that if it wasn't for 7 million voters, we would be in a police state right now, and Donald Trump would be dictator for life.
That's so interesting. That's, you also talk about the history of militias in this country, and why is it so important to look at how militias are formed and what motivates them, and also if you could talk about how our police and even our military are apt to be sort of pulled into, I think the Chicago police, didn't they vote supporting Trump's all the things that Trump had done so far, including the assault on the Capitol. Chicago police unions supported that, and what makes this assault so acceptable to our nation's police?
Well, Donald Trump was nurturing that relationship, but police in general, just by personality, the kind of person who wants to become a police officer, tends to be a person who is an authoritarian follower. About 20% of people in our society are authoritarian leaning. They get a sense of safety and security from having classes and orders among people. You know, that certain people are in certain economic and social classes, and they stay in those classes, and society is orderly and well-defined and all that kind of thing. And, it usually comes out of insecurity in childhood, but, it's about 20% of us. And those are the folks who become police. So when an authoritarian leader like Donald Trump comes along and says, hey, follow me, they recognize him as one of their own and fall into place. So it shouldn't surprise us. With regard to the militias, the actual militias in the United States, the militias that were referred to in the Second Amendment, are what we call the National Guard. Excuse me. And those are, those are our well-armed militias, or well-ordered militias, or whatever the phrase is. And I wrote about that extensively in the first book in the series, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. The people who are calling themselves militias now are really just basically white gangs. Who are terrorizing people in the name of white supremacy. And they have succeeded in getting the media to call them militias, but they have no historic relationship to actual militias.
Towards the end of your book, you talk about the oligarchs' media empire and how important the control of the media is. And you talk a little bit about challenging Murdoch's right-wing megaphone, essentially. How important is it for the citizenry to challenge Fox News and Murdoch's media empire?
Well, I think, you know, it's not just Rupert Murdoch. In the late 80s and throughout the 90s, there were a series of Supreme Court decisions, executive actions, and legislative actions that and FCC actions that all led to basically destroying the local ownership rules around local TV stations and local radio stations. And so now most of the TV and radio ecosystem of America is owned by a relatively small number of oligarchs or giant corporations that produce oligarchs. And Rupert Murdoch, case in point, he's a multi-billionaire, and you know he's our major media, one of our major media guys. And I think that what we need to do to deal with that is go back to those rules requiring local ownership of newspapers, radio stations, and television stations. I mean, it's nuts. The local newspaper here in Oregon, the Oregonian, is owned by a New York corporation. How do they care, or why would they care about what's going on in Oregon? You know, we really need, particularly for news vehicles, there needs to be local ownership. And this has been the law since the 1920s. And, you know, and it was an anti-oligarchy law at the time. You know, it was a way of pushing back. You know, against the oligarchs who were rising up during the Roaring Twenties. So it's just common sense. You know, we need to have local media.
Right. Another suggestion you make is what you call economic rights for everyone. And how does this challenge the oligarchies, the fact that people would have more rights than they do today, rights for health care, rights for housing, education? How does this threaten the oligarchs?
These were all things that Franklin Roosevelt proposed in his second Bill of Rights about 6 months before he died, and back in the 1940s. And he pointed out that each one of these things would actually make society stronger. A lot of this, Fred, goes back to the conservative idea. I mean, it's literally a founding idea of the modern conservative movement, started in 1651 when Thomas Hobbes published Leviathan and said that the inherent nature of people is evil, and that if man were to revert to his natural state, life would be nasty, brutish, and short. And that, you know, we're all born sinners and all that kind of stuff. And so we need the, as Hobbes said, you know, the iron fist of church or state to control our behavior. And that in modern terms is the sense that it's okay to embrace oligarchy. I mean, that is this conservative meme. In England, conservatives are called royalists. You know, it's embracing monarchy, which is, you know, just a, I mean, the queen is an oligarch as well. So the counter to that argument came from John Locke about 40 years after Hobbes was writing in the 1760s and 1770s in his second treatise on government. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was writing at the same time and saying essentially the same things, only doing it from a sociological perspective instead of a legal perspective. And that is that the core nature of people is actually good, and that evil people are an aberration, and therefore democracy is possible. I mean, if you assume that everybody's evil at their core, it becomes really difficult to figure out a way to construct a functioning republic where the people have any say in their leaders. It was an issue that John Calvin struggled with back in the 1600s, and the conclusion he came to was, you know, we're all born of women, therefore we're all contaminated with original sin, therefore we're all evil. So how do we find the good people among us? Well, we look for God's blessing. God has picked some of us. Calvin believed in predestination. God picked some of us before we were even born to be rich. And those rich people are the people that God has bestowed his blessing on. So the rich people should run the world. And that idea of John Calvin's animates the modern Calvinism, which is the religion that Betsy DeVos is a member of. Surprise, surprise, she's a billionaire.
Sure.
And largely has taken over the Republican Party over the last 100 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Your book is interesting because ideas show up that I wouldn't expect in reviewing Teddy Roosevelt's suggestions, for example. You find these economic rights there as well, the Tillman Act, and that made it illegal to contribute for corporations to contribute to candidates, did it? The Tillman Act.
Yeah. Well, the extension of all this thing of the conservative liberal divide is that if you believe people are fundamentally good, then providing them with the necessities of life, you know, good education, housing, food, a reasonable living, makes perfect sense. But if you believe that everybody's evil and
to fail, you know.
Right. Then providing people with support is simply going to encourage them to be slothful and lazy and to take things that aren't theirs. And those are the arguments that we've been hearing, you know, between Republicans and Democrats for all of my lifetime. Mm-hmm. Republicans saying, you know, giving people free stuff, you know, just encourages them to be lazy. And Democrats mm-hmm. saying, no, if you provide a, you know, we're providing a foundation for people to stand on, to build their lives on. Mm-hmm. We're providing a rich soil for businesses and individuals to root themselves in to become prosperous. And it comes out of these different perspectives. And Teddy Roosevelt got that. It's why they called him the oligarchs of their day, of his day, called him a traitor to his class.
Hmm. Just like they called FDR the traitor to his class, right? That's interesting.
Same thing, yeah. Yeah, they were cousins.
One of the things that you sort of steer clear of in the book is America's endless wars abroad. And how the oligarchies, you know, get richer through the Defense Department, the Pentagon, and inciting more wars. Did you think that wasn't such an important way to look at the takeover of our country by rich people, or maybe you just weren't able to fit that in, or maybe you don't believe that the endless wars have something to do with an oligarchy?
There, you know, if you look at, for example, the oil industry, you see the Koch brothers, you know, who made their fortune in oil. You look at the telecom industry and you see the family that owns Comcast that made their fortune, you know, with cable TV and ISPs. You look at the banking industry, you look at, in most industries, you can identify, you know, the retail industry, you've got the Walton family, which is collectively worth over $100 billion. And you know, Amazon, you got Jeff Bezos. Mm. Of any individual families that have reached major oligarch status and are using that status with a lot of political activity, specifically in the defense industry. It seems to me more that you have a collection of corporations that have found profit. They can make money supplying weaponry to the defense industry. And they use the same weapons, tools, and routes, politically speaking, that oligarchs do to get what they want out of Congress, you know, the same carrots and sticks. But it's more based on industry than could say the same thing about airlines. You know, since Howard Hughes mm-hmm. died, we haven't really had an airline oligarch. You know, the CEOs, they'll make $10 or $20 million a year, but that's not oligarchy.
Yeah.
I just didn't see a clear relationship there.
Right. Well, we're almost finished. One more question, and I think this might be a good question to end on. Why is it important that Trump and his henchmen be prosecuted for what they've done?
Because when oligarchs rise up and try to destroy democracy, if they are not utterly crushed, they come back. There's a joke circulating. What do you call a failed coup? is the question. The joke answer is a dress rehearsal. And if you didn't like what happened on January 6th, hang on to your hat, because if those guys aren't prosecuted and if Trump isn't taken down and if the whole collection of members of Congress who facilitated this and continue to support this treason get away with it, they will be back. And the next standard bearer that they will have won't be Donald Trump. It'll be somebody a lot smarter and a lot more cunning than Donald Trump. It'll be somebody like Josh Hawley or Tom Cotton, who will not just become an oligarch and rule the nation, but will end democracy in this country, in my opinion.
Well, Tom Harbin, thank you so much for writing this book, which I really, I loved reading it. I mean, you can read it in a couple of days, and it's full of notes too, so I highly recommend The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. Thank you for writing the book, and thank you so much for being on Activist Radio today.
Well, thank you for having me, Fred. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Great. Thanks. Bye now.
Bye now.
Activist Radio can be heard Thursdays 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. on WIOF 104.1 FM in Woodstock, New York. And Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. from the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. Past shows can be heard on ClassWars.org. Please like our Facebook page, read our ClassWars blog for commentary on today's interview. We'll be here next week at the same time to help you become part of the resistance.